Hello. Welcome to our discussion of leadership in a crisis. And thank you all for joining us here today in the beautiful space underneath Trinity Church and supporting the Boston Book Festival. I'm Olive Dara, and I have the pleasure of sharing the stage seats with these three terrific authors whose books I've enjoyed reading over the last couple of months. And I'm just going to do a quick introduction and then ask each of our authors to read an extract of their book, which they've put a lot of thought into, and some who say they don't normally read extracts of their business books, but they're going to do that today for us. I think I have some questions, and then we'll have plenty of time for Q&A at the end. And I would just remind, when you go to Q&A, please go to the microphone, because you're being recorded, and we need to be able to hear what you're asking. Thank you. All right, so I will start with Christopher here, and Christopher Gorham is the author of The Confidant, this wonderful book about Anna Rosenberg, whom you all should learn to know about, and you will. Christopher is a history teacher at Westford Academy just outside Boston. He has degrees in history from Tufts, a university we all know well, and the University of Michigan, where they've been comparing the football scores. but Michigan's doing okay, right?
35-7.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And he also has a JD from Syracuse University. So he was a lawyer by trade, but has now become a history teacher. And he served in the editorial staff of the Syracuse Law Review, and his writing has appeared in papers from the Washington Post to the Literary Hub. But this is his first book.
That's right.
So, and it's a great story about how it came about, so I think we'll learn about that. Next to Christopher is Moira Ahrens-Milley, who has one of the... Moira is the host of The Anxious Achiever, and if you haven't listened to her podcast, you should. It's really a fascinating podcast, and apparently one of the top 10 management podcasts that helps people rethink their relationship with mental health and their leadership, and I think that's something today that's increasingly important. Moira founded Women Online and The Mission List, an award-winning digital consulting firm, an influence marketing company dedicated to social change in 2010. She sold that business in 2001, and along the way she helped Hillary Clinton log on for her first internet chat and launch digital campaigns for President Obama, Malia Yousafzai, and the United Nations and the CDC, which now I think it's amazing we think politics is so social media driven, but it's not that long ago that it wasn't. She lives outside Boston with her family and what she describes as her menagerie. So, and at the end here we have President Lynn Wooten from Simmons College here, which many of you know. And Lynn is a seasoned academic, an expert in organizational development transformation, and she's the 9th president of Simmons University. She is the first African American to lead the organization, and she specializes in crisis leadership, diversity and inclusion, positive leadership. Dr. Wooten is an innovative leader and prolific author and presenter. She comes to Simmons from Cornell University, where she was the David J. Nolan Professor of Management and Organizations at the Dyson School of Applied Economics and Management. And Dr. Wooten is the author of nearly 30 journal articles, more than 15 book chapters, and 4 books. This includes The Prepared Leader and the Wall Street Journal bestselling article, Arrive and Thrive. And I think what's wonderful about President Wooten's story is she, with her co-author, Erica James, who is now the dean of the Wharton School, both she and Erica took on these significant leadership jobs in July of 2020 at universities under crisis. So she knows a lot about the need to lead under crisis from the very first go. So I'm going to ask each of the authors now to read a short extract from their book, and then we're going to talk about some of the things that sort of the themes that, or potential themes that run through their work. And Christopher, shall we start with you?
That sounds good. I'm going to give a little context before I read, because reading from nonfiction, right, there's always a little bit of a...
Yes.
The book is about Anna Rosenberg, who was a advisor to, in a nutshell, an advisor to Franklin Roosevelt through really his governorship in New York through the New Deal, World War II, and then became Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Korean War. I don't want to give too much away, because I want you all to buy the book. As World War II came closer to the United States in 1941, President Roosevelt pulled her closer and ever closer into his inner circle, where she was, well, she'd been a mediator, a pioneer in mediation, and she was just an ace problem solver. So she had worked and solved a number of problems for Franklin Roosevelt for a number of years, even before he became the president. So here he is as president. It's World War II, and there's a lot of crisis, you know, crisis going on, none bigger than the Second World War. At this point, one of her nicknames, Anna Rosenberg, was Seven Job Anna. So she was doing a number of things for the American people and for the president. This particular job was, and you can get a flavor for who she was and how she operated. She had been made by FDR the head of the newly created Office of Defense, Health, and Welfare. And her assistant was none other than David Rockefeller of the Rockefeller Brothers, of the Rockefeller Center. She not only was a mentor to David Rockefeller, but also Nelson Rockefeller. And her job was, she's about 41 years old. Her job was to ensure transportation, housing, schooling, health facilities, and public safety for the cities and regions and expanded military bases in New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. That was her job, one of her seven jobs. Once a month, Anna and her staff met with military, municipal, and industry leaders in the ballroom of the Hotel Astor in Times Square. Perched on the stage were Anna and her staff. Now, Anna is 5'3". On the long table sat two telephones, a black one and a red one. The red one, Anna said, was a direct line to the White House. The monthly meeting started with a recap of the last meeting's priorities. David, meaning David Rockefeller. David, where's our list? Okay, now, Admiral, last month you promised you would soon have more housing in your Navy Yard, yes? Well, Mrs. Rosenberg, you see, not yet, Admiral? I see, am I seeing the housing? Well, no, Mrs. Rosenberg, there's a problem. We can't get enough lumber. Anna grabbed the red line. Anna Rosenberg here. Is he there? Good, fine. Listen, Admiral Smith says, thanks. See you soon. Goodbye, darling. She was a Hungarian immigrant and spoke with a little bit of an accent. It took just a minute. According to David Rockefeller's assistant, in the several meetings I attended, I was unable to ascertain whether the red phone was actually connected to any terminal, let alone one at the White House. Nevertheless, the missing lumber, the elusive plumbing, or the scarce medical supplies somehow soon appeared where needed.
I like that. That's great. Okay. After so many years of living with anxiety and working in high-pressure environments, along with years of writing about, speaking on, and studying anxiety, leadership, and adult development, I'm convinced anxiety is based into effective leadership. Doesn't matter if you have a fancy title and are managing thousands of people, or you're launching a tiny startup on a shoestring. Leadership comes with a heightened set of pressures and responsibilities. And when you're the one enacting a vision, setting the tone, managing people, and ensuring outcomes, much depends on you. If you're invested in the work, you're going to experience some anxiety. Imagine you're the first person in your family to attend college in an office where people seem to have multi-generational Ivy League degrees. You've always excelled. And now you're on your way with a promising career in a great corporate job. You like it and you're good at it, but you often feel like you don't fit in. Your background, history, and cultural identity differ from those of most of your coworkers. And then one day you're sitting in a meeting with your boss, preparing to speak, and someone makes an offhand remark about the culture of your upbringing that cuts you to the core. Was it meant for you? Was it an accident? Does it matter if it was an accident or not? A career full of such incidents creates anxiety. Even healthy organizations generate stress and anxiety simply by the way as they're structured and managed. Multi-group and hierarchical structures trigger competition, a prime stressor for power, influence, and status. And the almost universal practice of creating goals, plans, and budgets that are used to set direction, evaluate performance, and in many cases, determine compensation naturally creates stress and anxiety. And while there's something to be said for feeling just enough anxiety to galvanize action and enhance performance, a theme that is really about my work and this book, how do I turn my anxiety into an ally? There's no question that many of us find our competitive environments stressful and anxiety-provoking. Everyone brings their individual anxieties and their varying temperaments to work. It's impossible not to, right? Wherever you go, there you are. And leadership sometimes requires us to navigate difficult relationships and manage difficult people. Even when you luck out and you work with a dream team, people are complex, messy, might be a better descriptor. And most of us bring unresolved issues that drive our behavior, whether we're aware of them or not. Those of us who are anxious by nature will react differently to stressful situations than those who are not. Some of us have neurobiological or inherited conditions. We have ADHD or bipolar disorder, as I do, that remain undiagnosed and produce anxiety and difficult behavior. And we all act out our anxieties and old hurts that we don't even know we have. Leaders need to be prepared to guide their teams through the baggage of interpersonal stuff that drives individual behaviors and thus organizational life. All of which to say, anxiety comes with the job.
I love how you say leaders need to be prepared, and we see that Anna was prepared.
Yes.
Right. The bubble. Adam Silver is the commissioner of the National Basketball Association, the NBA in the United States. In 2020, he made a bold decision, one that made headlines around the world. On March 11, the same day that the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a pandemic, Silver announced that the NBA would be suspending the season for the first time in almost 80 years history. The suspension would cost the league hundreds of millions of dollars in lost revenue. But Silver was adamant. This was a decision, he told reporters, that was based on facts. By this, Silver meant he had looked at the evidence, he had sought counsel of others, healthcare experts and scientists, to make sense of it and determine what it meant for players and for fans. Public health, he affirmed, was of paramount importance, outweighing any other concern. And once he made this position clear, he set about building support and alignment from within the organization. NBA leadership, team owners, players, physicians, trainers, arena staffs were brought on board. Silver also built a coalition of expertise that extended beyond the boundaries of his organization, tapping into diversity of skills, prowess, and know-how to manage the situation and, most importantly, devise a solution. What was the result of all this? The first and arguably largest bubble of our pandemic era, an NBA isolation zone in which players were kept free from infection and played a full 172 games, even as the virus raged through the United States and beyond. Enacting the isolation zone is reported to have cost the league $190 million, but it was recouped a stunning $1.5 billion in otherwise lost revenue, without a single case of infection among players or staff during its existence. The NBA bubble passed into organizational protocol as a result of its success and became a contingency plan for future crises. Silver's decision probably saved lives, not just among NBA employees and teams, but among its legions of fans around the country. Some have called it a decision that changed the course of the pandemic in the United States in 2020. It's demonstrating the agency of leadership in a crisis. The NBA example speaks to the incredible difference that informed, inclusive, and inspirational leadership can make when chips are down. In a crisis, your leadership matters. It is the most critical factor that can shape impact, outcomes, and outlooks. That's because in a crisis, leaders make decisions that will make a difference. Without effective leadership, the impact of any crisis will always be worse. The quality of your leadership will determine not only the immediate outcomes of a crisis, but also the longer-term outlooks when the crisis is over.
Thank you. Well, as you can see just from this short sample of their reading, these books are very well worth reading. And so we're just going to talk about a couple of things that I think are thematic through all of the books. And we'll start, I think, Maura, with you, because this idea of leadership and being a prepared leader and how how we handle it when we are naturally anxious. We are all anxious, as you say, in different degrees and manifests itself in very different ways. And you talk a lot about public speaking. And for some of us, no matter how many times we do it, we're still nervous when we do it. And we do our best to hide it, but we still have to do it. So maybe we can talk a little bit about, for each of you, how do you see managing that anxiety? And also, as we talked about, anxiety can be a double-edged sword in terms of being anxious may make you a more prepared leader, as President Wooten talks about, that actually it makes you think about the things that might happen and you actually are prepared for them. So maybe, Maura, we could start with you. How do you think about and what tricks and techniques are there for handling that anxiety when you're under a crisis situation?
You need to be anxious before you take the stage, right? Or before you hit anything that demands your full attention and that you're invested in and that you care about. And I think that one of the things, I talk to a lot of graduate students and people in elite universities, you know this world well, and I tell them that anxiety is not something to be scared of, denied, hidden, or even controlled. And I say this as a person with a raging anxiety disorder who has been through some really rough times with my anxiety, because we need anxiety. And leadership demands it, right? And you have some wonderful instruction and stories about how the ability to look forward and be vigilant and even take on the potential of threat, which is what anxiety is really crucial. The key is that when you're always anxious, and anyone who lives with anxiety knows this, when everything's always at an 11, it drains you and it creates mental illness and burnout. And so the work that we have to do, especially for people who are wired a little bit more anxious, is to manage that anxiety and to know when it's go time and to know when we have to employ those strategies to calm it and try to take a beat.
Yep, it's very helpful. Yeah. And I think that relates to, and we talked this about with Anna and also the examples President Wooten has in her book about why we lead, right? What we are doing, that one of the things we can rely on is the why of what we're doing, the reasons that drive us to do what we do. And maybe, Christopher, you can talk a little bit about what you see. I mean, there's not a lot of evidence that Anna suffered from anxiety in the book, or at least she doesn't talk about it. We don't know.
Right.
She didn't even have a high school. She didn't graduate from high school because she got expelled. But she, you know, she was in very high-powered circles. But she doesn't, and she lived in a world of crisis. If it wasn't a war, it was she was being attacked by McCarthy. She was, I mean, all, how do you think she, this, what kept her thinking about what she wanted to accomplish?
Well, I think she did not herself, Anna Rosenberg, complain about having anxiety. She certainly felt it, no question, right, given all the crises that she lived through and dealt with. Interesting vignette from the book of how she might have dealt with her anxiety was a comment that Eleanor Roosevelt told her. Anna Rosenberg had been tasked with coming up with a mediation between the White House and the black leadership in 1941 because the industry, the defense industry jobs were only being given to white Americans. So there was going to be a march on Washington by the black leader of the day, A. Philip Randolph. And Franklin Roosevelt, Eleanor Roosevelt was sympathetic with this. Franklin Roosevelt was in a bit of a bind because he had the Southern lawmakers to deal with. So he entrusted Anna Rosenberg to come up with a mediation that would satisfy both the White House and the black leadership. The anxiety part comes here. Eleanor Roosevelt said, well, now that this is drafted, this executive order, you have to get the boss to sign it. So Eleanor Roosevelt said, Anna, I want you to go down to Georgetown in Washington, D.C. and buy yourself one of those fancy hats that you love so much and get yourself the confidence to come back and walk into the president's office. And sure enough, that's what she did. She came back. She took the draft. She had the brand new hat. She took the draft out of her purse and said, sign it, Mr. President, sign it. And he listened. And, you know, it's an executive order that mandated fairness in defense hiring was thereby signed and delivered, and both sides were happy. And that's a kind of a funny story, but she did deal with her anxiety by being on time, being early, by always being prepared, both in terms of her appearance, but also the data. She did the homework. I mean, she knew the issues inside and out in ways that she would be entrusted by Roosevelt to go lobby on Capitol Hill. You know, Roosevelt would say, go talk to the men up on the Hill. They were all men. And she would have done the homework and checked it all and gone up and onto Capitol Hill and lobbied on behalf of what the president wanted to have done. So by personal appearance, by having done the homework, by having the data at her fingertips, sometimes the unlit cigarette helped too. Yeah. But those are, I think, the ways that Anna Rosenberg dealt with what must have been tremendous anxiety.
Yeah. I mean, I can't imagine how challenging her situation was. And she didn't have power. She had influence, but she had no power.
Yes. Right.
So I think that was, and I think, President, when you read some of the things in your book and some of the examples about how people are clearly, you know, have, from Adam Silver to the CEO of Mercury, I think, like, they had to be extremely anxious about whether they're going to have to lay off their whole staff, like, what's going to happen?
Right, operations. Yeah. Yep. And we talk about anxiety in the format of the flip side about being resilient. And we even have a resilience tool on jamesandwooten.com. And part of it is, you're right, everybody has this. And the first thing is we say is give yourself grace and know what you need to give yourself grace. I'm a napper. So when I'm anxious, I need to take a good nap, right? I need that to come. It's not the unlit cigarette. I need a nap. Maybe shopping too, like Anna. So, but no, give yourself grace, take a pause, and then start to say, okay, what's causing me anxiety? What's changing in my world? And how do I learn how to adapt to that? How do I broaden my networks so that I can adapt to? So you can say, what do I need to learn and who do I need to work with, right? We all have anxiety. Why were people hoarding toilet paper and paper towels during the pandemic? Right. That's an example of that. But once you take that deep breath and ask, who do I need to partner with, who do I need to learn? I tell people, come up with a theory of change. What am I going to change to be better and enact that? There was a CEO that we interviewed who had a horrible crisis happen to his museum. He said he sat in the car and he cried. And then thought about who he needed to partner with, thought about what he needed to do, got out the car, and came up with a plan to save his museum.
Yep, and I think we all deal with things. I think the joke I always tell you guys is that I grew up in Northern Ireland in the Troubles. So when I get really anxious, I tell myself, well, the IRA didn't kill me, so this probably isn't going to kill me either, which is probably not the healthiest way to think about it. But it's sort of a, you know, when I flew after 9/11, which was very anxious, I kind of thought, well, you know, I made it this far, so it should be okay. But we all have ways of helping ourselves think about that. And I think one of the things that you just mentioned, President Wooden, I think is really important, is other people in this conversation. Right? We are never leaders by ourselves.
Right. It's not a solo journey.
No matter how great we think we are, or how bad we think we are not a leader by ourselves. So maybe we can talk a little bit about the people and the power of reaching out when you're under crisis. Because I do think some people have a natural tendency, and I think, Maura, you mentioned a CEO who like sat in the office and ran numbers, which probably would have been my instinct at some point. There's about to be a spreadsheet that would fix this. But that's not probably the best way to have people come along with you on the journey.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think there's interesting examples with Anna and her tea, making everybody have tea with her. So maybe we can talk a little bit about this need and how you make sure you bring other voices into the conversation. Maura, did you want to?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, and one of the problems is when you are anxious, you have a tendency to come inward and you don't reach out. And so I think that's why the importance of having a team who knows you warts and all is I call it infrastructure. And I think about Abraham Lincoln a lot. You know, Abraham Lincoln was clinically depressed. Today, he would have had multiple diagnoses. His mental illness was a huge piece of his life. And of course, he led through one of the biggest crises we've ever known. Ever since Lincoln was a young lawyer in Illinois, he had people around him who fed him, lent him money, made sure when he was really depressed that he wasn't alone, and sometimes who even hid razors from him. And Lincoln was extremely open about this. Lincoln didn't hide it. And what that meant was, as Lincoln ascended to the highest office in the land, he always had people who would come in and help, and he didn't have to ask for it. And I think that's amazing, but you can't get there if you're not vulnerable and you're not honest and open. And if you're always, I've got it, I know the answers, it's going to be fine, I'll just figure it out, I'll just work till 1 a.m. and it'll be fine. You don't ever let people help you. So,
yep, it's very helpful.
You know, it's the importance of having diversity. When you heard Adam Silver, he had physicians, he had his own MBA team, he had scientists, he was listening to the media. So having a diversity, you call it infrastructure, I call it your personal board of directors, and getting feedback from all of those people. Also, it's important, I love the story of the emperor's new clothes. You need someone who's going to get on your nerves, but who's going to tell you the truth. So those provocateurs, yes. You need the people who are going to sit there and hold your hand, but you also need someone who's going to challenge you for the status quo to stretch you.
Yep. Yeah. And I think Anna played that role for a lot of presidents, mm-hmm. right? She probably, and as a woman, she may even have had, we've talked about this panel, it could be about women leadership too, in a sense, is that she was able to maybe tell them some things that some of their male colleagues might not have been able to tell them, right? And she obviously had lots of friends, men and women, whom she talked to all the time.
Absolutely right. Maura was talking about the 16th president. The 32nd president, Roosevelt, faced with the existential crisis of his century. You know, it's just incredible. The Chicago Tribune said, next to perhaps Harry Hopkins, Anna Rosenberg might have been the closest person to the president during the war years. And if you thought that was an overstatement, it was corroborated by General Eisenhower's chief of staff, who said, you know, next to some of President Roosevelt's secretaries, you know, very few people were as close to the president in problem solving as Anna Rosenberg. So for, you know, like the other panelists up here have said, to solve problems, you don't do it alone. In fact, that's a hallmark of bad leadership in a lot of ways, right? And Roosevelt was able to, you know, pick this civilian woman, you know, this younger businesswoman from New York who had the knack for solving problems. You know, whatever she came up against, she would solve that problem with efficiency and with tremendous insight and knowledge. And, you know, she helped the president, not only Roosevelt, you know, achieve victory in World War II on the home front and abroad, but then went on to be a close advisor to Truman, to Eisenhower, and to Lyndon Johnson. So, you know, so these to their credit, to the president's, those presidents' credit, they realized there was a person out there that could be just an incredible, extraordinary problem solver to help them achieve their policy goals at some of the most critical times in modern American history. Mm.
And I think that what comes out when you look at some of these leaders from Adam Silver, who I think did a phenomenal job during the COVID, is they are doing what they do, not just, I mean, and Lynn talked specifically about some of the financial consequences of what was going on with the NBA, but you also sense that Adam Silver thought about something else, which was the importance of making this happen. It wasn't just about money, right? It was about the message of the NBA, the power of that. Maura, you talk a lot about that in terms of the, you know, we go back to our values, who we are, why we are doing what we're doing. And so maybe we could talk just a little bit, too, about the need to tap into why we do what we do. So it's not just, and I think you see it in a lot of leaders during COVID, those who thought a lot about their staff, not just about, is my business going to go away? But I have all of these employees that I want to make sure are going to be okay. Like, I actually care about this business. So maybe we could talk a little bit about that, like the importance of the values that drive you to make your leadership decisions. Because without that moral, that compass, you can end up in a pretty bad place.
Yeah. You know, the why, most people think people go for the leadership because it's glamorous. It's not glamorous, right? Most leaders are called to it. And it's aligned with their values. And for Adam Silvers, it was like his values was that the NBA does bring a lot of people joy.
Yep.
And so even in the midst of a pandemic, how can we continue that joy safely? You think about Anna and her love for the United States and what this country did for her, and that's how she played it forward. The leaders in your book were the same way. So knowing your values, knowing your identities, and then knowing your strengths, because your strengths are going to want to get you through. If you're a data analysis, or if you're a people person, or if you're a coordinator or something, are all so important.
Yeah.
Maura, do you want to?
I mean, anybody can hook into their values, and it's actually a great tool. So, you know, if you are feeling overwhelmed, you're sitting at your desk and you're anxious and you're overwhelmed, or I always tell the story that for me, for many years as a consultant, I had to fly all the time, and I had terrible, terrible flying anxiety. I would dose myself up with so much Xanax, I could barely move. But I would sit on the runway, and I would be convinced that plane was not going to make it, but then I would hook into my values, and I would close my eyes, and I would see my children, and I would see my staff, and I would say, you're doing this for a reason. You have your children to care for. You have your staff. You love your business. And just that mere act of switching off the anxiety and focusing, just hooking into the values, is really helpful. And sometimes that can be hard to do if you're in a really anxious state in your body. But if you're able, when you're feeling very overwhelmed and scared, to just have the moment, and the values could be small. They don't have to be, I'm going to save the NBA, you know? But it is so, so crucial to be able to tap into your why.
Yep. And I think when you read about Anna, I think, you know, her father, like, ingrained her in this incredible love of the United States, but also just her humanitarian view of whether it was women or people of color, or, you know, she had this sort of sense that everybody needed, giving everyone an opportunity to be successful, and she was able to influence that in many ways, right?
Absolutely right. From the time she was an immigrant girl in New York City, you know, around the time of the First World War, she was consistently a champion of American values, or what most of us would think of American values. First and foremost, the symphony of civilization, you know, the pluralism of our country, and that every bit of that country ought to have social equality and social recognition. That just never deviated. You know, whether it was women, it was Black Americans, it was Americans with disabilities. You know, she went to bat for those groups consistently throughout her long, long career. I kept waiting for a document, you know, a file, a comment to a wrong foot, a wrong step. She just did not deviate. Those were embedded in her, maybe even from her father. Yep. But the values that a lot of us associate with the best of America, they drove her to sacrifice. You know, she certainly in 1950 maybe didn't want to go back to Washington and spend another couple of years, those long days and that arduous schedule. But she could not say no to her country when General Marshall asked her to join him at the Pentagon. And it was because of those values.
Wow. And I think that's, you know, under she was involved in a lot of huge societal crises like the Second World War, but she also had the personal crisis of being attacked by McCarthy. And I think for all of us as leaders, it is one thing to have, you know, when you see your organization is being challenged, but when you personally are being challenged, Maura used the example, was somebody making fun of my background there? Was that personal? That is a very different kind of leadership challenge, right? When you feel it's actually aimed at you as an individual, right? And, you know, there are different ways that folks respond to that. But how do you think about managing that when some of that crisis feels so personal?
You know, one thing is, a lot of times when people are being attacked on a personal level, it's really not about you, it's about the other person.
Yep.
And so working through those interpersonal dynamics to understand what's going on, using emotional intelligence, and the best thing is, how do we come to a win-win? You have some, now with Anna, that was beyond.
Right.
It wasn't that easy to do with Anna, with her attacks, but it's getting outside of the personal and thinking about how, what's going on, and how we can come on a win-win.
Right.
Having those kind of crucial conversations.
Yep.
I don't know what you've seen, Maura.
You know, I have a chapter in the book about your childhood. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you could argue that a chapter about your childhood doesn't belong in a business book, but it does.
It does.
Because we all bring our self to work, and that self is full of hurts, right. A lifetime of hurts. And when we are self-aware and we know what's going to trigger us, we can protect ourselves. You know, I mean, I think that no one in a position of leadership has ever said that people are nice to me all the time.
Right.
Yeah. And people...
Lynn said, it's not glamorous.
Right.
It's not glamorous.
Yeah. And we all have our vulnerabilities, right? I mean, I think that, you know, in all the research and interviews, and I've interviewed hundreds and hundreds of leaders who have mental illness, who manage anxiety, a lot of them have vulnerabilities from their childhood. They have money stories. They grew up with not enough money. They grew up in a divorced household where money was used as a pawn. They have a vulnerability around money that leaves them open as they grow into their business selves to getting really anxious and triggered around money. And you've got to deal with that. I work with sales teams who have complicated anxiety around money, and you can't sell and live in a business money transaction world when you don't think you deserve money. And so we bring these whole stories. Right. Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, I think we're going to go to some Q&A, and I would remind you there's a standing microphone here, so please feel free to come to the microphone and ask a question, and just wait till it's on, right? Yep. So, here we go. Thank you. Excellent.
And thank you, panel. I'm wondering, in terms of leadership today, given the complexities, given the amount of fear, anxiety in the world, how is it that leaders can deal with the nuances of problem solving versus the polarities?
Oh, God. Great question.
What would Anna, what would Anna do?
I would hope that the two of you also add on to this response, but I think it goes back to the North Star. Have the ideals, have the conviction of what you think is right, and let that be your guide. And I think she would be guided by what she thought was best for the country and best for most people in the country.
Yep. I think it's being authentic. What we've seen in the last week is we have to give each other grace and realize that all of us make mistakes.
Yes.
But saying, I made a mistake, I wanted to solve the problem, and this is how I'm going forward. And we got to move from this polarization, from the me to the we, if we want a great future.
Mm. Yeah. I would add that social media makes it really hard to have nuance.
Yes.
And that is a huge challenge for any leader. And we live in a time when it's really difficult to have nuance. And so I think that leaders really need to think about the role of amplification and the fact that you're always on the record and you're always on camera in a way that probably she didn't.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep. And I think that you watched that this week with everything that's going on since I live in Cambridge with Harvard. And I felt a great deal for President Gay because I felt like, why don't people just talk to her instead of putting all very, very well-known people who will remain nameless but have a bit of a history of being misogynistic. And instead of attacking the woman, I mean, instead of attacking her, go talk to her. She probably would have picked up the phone. He probably has a real phone, and he probably could have picked up the phone. But instead, so I just feel like this in the world today, like there's more, we've lost that sort of, instead of picking up the phone and saying, you know, I didn't love that statement, perhaps you need to be more definitive about this, instead of turning it into a, you know, front page of the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times.
The performative nature.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It's very challenging.
Yeah.
Hi, good afternoon once again. Thank you for being here. LaTanya Maxwell, Simmons University. I have a more of a lighthearted question.
Excellent.
For all the inspiring authors in the room, what word of advice or what was your aha moment to begin to write your book instead of just thinking about writing it?
Excellent. That's a good one.
Aha moment for me was when my wife and I first saw the Anna Rosenberg's papers at Schlesinger Library at Harvard. And it was with some of my high school students. I'm a high school history teacher. And one of the students said, Mr. Gorham, you have to come look at this. And it was the citation from President Truman awarding her the very first Medal of Freedom. And it was just, wow. And then a few minutes after that, you know, I was holding a business card from Eleanor Roosevelt, you know, and on the back of it, it said, you know, dear Anna, next time you're in New York, let's have lunch. And it was an aha moment because I said right then and there to myself, if there's not a book about this woman yet, there's going to be one, and I'm going to be the one to try and write it.
That's an amazing story.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
You want more?
Yes. What are yours? You know, I have been studying crisis for 25 plus years, and I had this aha moment. I had written journal articles about it, very technical, very theoretical, but I wanted something that could be a gift to a world, something that was applicable, tools, storytelling, and case studies to share.
And boy, was it right on time.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, made me think about all the mistakes I'd made, though. When I read all those leadership things, I should have been doing. Oops, I didn't do that. Maura, you write a great deal anyway, but.
I mean, I think for me, I just started talking about how my own anxiety disorder affected everything I did. I would talk to my clients about it. I blogged. I wrote about it. I gave a talk at my alma mater, Brown University, to 250 seniors in 2012, and I talked about it, and they gave me a standing ovation, which was weird if you think about it. And I thought, God, we need to talk about this. We hate talking about mental illness in this country. We just hate it. And when you talk about it in the context of success, people get very woolly, but I think it's really important.
Yep, it's great. Any other questions? Yep, there we go. Thank you.
Yep. Who are the leaders you most admire today? Any field?
I'm gonna think about that while he's more.
That's not fair. Come on.
Well, I'm gonna answer it in respond. What I would like to see in leaders today is, that's a tough one. I mean,
oh God.
What I would like to see, I'll make it sort of easier for me to answer this. What is such a keystone of good leadership is to go out there and find people that will tell you no, that will tell you you're not right, you're doing this is a wrong decision, packing the court is a bad idea, don't do it. And I think too many times we have leaders at very, very high levels of our national government that surround themselves with sycophants and people that are going to tell them what they want to hear instead of what they need to hear. And I think good leadership requires the inner toughness to be able to have people around you that will tell you you're wrong. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think about the New Zealand Prime Minister and how she handled the pandemic era and even brought her sense of identity with it. One of her talks, she says to the students, the children in New Zealand, and the Easter Bunny's still going to find your house in the pandemic. Right. So thinking about those type of things. And when she was tired and burned out, she stepped down. Yeah. So she made time for self-care. She did her leadership why. She served the country, and then she moved on. So her identity and her resiliency, I admire. Mara?
I sort of think what's happening in Michigan with the auto workers strike is really interesting. And I admire Gretchen Whitmer, and I admire the union leaders who are stepping up, and that gives me hope.
Mm. Well, yeah. I don't know. That is an interesting question. And I think this is a silly thing to say, but I was thinking about any of you who watched Ted Lasso? Mm-hmm. Rebecca, who's that head of the football?
Oh, gee.
It's a bad
time. What was I thinking about?
Ted Lasso.
Yeah. But I was thinking about the type of leader that she is in an all-men's world, right? And there's this funny scene where she's in a group with all of these men, and they're talking about a fictional thing of the Super League. And I don't know if you're not football, soccer fans, you would. But the Super League was this thing where all the super wealthy owners wanted to get together and bring all the big clubs into a Super League. And fortunately, a whole lot of club leaders, real club leaders, stood up, including the guys who own Liverpool who were here in Boston, stood up and said, no, we aren't doing that. It's not right for the fans. It's not right for the clubs. And they basically take some of these guys said, and they put she in this meeting with all these men says no. And she says a great thing, which I think struck me a lot, is we may own these clubs, but they don't belong to us. Mm. We don't own, and I thought that this, it made me think about, because I was reading actually this, I'm thinking about Adam Silver, about The NBA is not about him. The NBA is going to live long before him, and it's going to live long after him, hopefully. So I think that there's, you know, that it made me. It's not a real. Someone wrote that, obviously, but it struck me that a lot of the there were some people during that crisis who stepped up and said, you know, it's not about the immediate ability to make money. These things don't belong to us. They matter to someone else. So, but I think, I mean, obviously, Jacinta Ardern was an incredible leader, but I think it was sad that she was so burnt out from it that she retired so early.
Yeah. She'll come back to something.
Hopefully she will.
I mean, look at Jimmy Carter.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Somebody who's resilient. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Young man.
You talked about having people around you to help lead you and keep you going in the right direction. But how would you go about finding those people that will be there and that you can rely on them?
That's a great question.
Great question.
I think what Dr. Wooten said is the importance of having diverse voices and having folks from different backgrounds, whether it's social, economic, whether it's racial or religious or just other background, you know, to surround yourself with people that share your exact background, I don't think is going to get you the it's not going to be the feedback of the country that we live in, you know, the symphony. And so I think that's critical.
So diversity, honesty, and then people you can trust. Right, are really important.
And when you're young in your career, that I think is not always easy, right? Many of us had the benefit of being in organizations, like I was at McKinsey for a year. They assign you a development group leader when you first join. So they assign you a person who's responsible for you. That person, in my case, has been a lifelong sponsor and someone I've trusted and still work with to this day. But I think it is important to find peers that you truly trust, where you can shut the door and you can say, can you believe what the hell is going on out there today? I mean, you need that in your life, I think. And so, and I totally agree with Christopher that you need to find people who don't look like you, who don't necessarily come at the problem the way you do. But I think the other thing is, you know that you have to invest in those relationships, right? Mm-hmm. If you find someone who is, you think can be part of your personal board of directors, then you invest in them so that you're there for them too. But I think it is watching the people around you who behave the way that you admire, right? Because you will see when you're young in your career, lots of leadership and engagement styles, and some will appeal to you and some won't. And I think more in your book, you talk about how we venerate the Elon Musks because they're loud and they're like just, you know, the sort of that, we venerate sort of that outgoing, you know, very vocal leadership. But I think a lot of leadership is much quieter. And I think that you see that in the people in your lives and finding a way to connect with them.
And I will say some of my most beloved mentors and colleagues come from people I've met online, LinkedIn. Yeah. Like I was never the kind of person, I never had mentorship at work, at school. But as I grew in my career, I would find people whose writing I admired or who I'd connect with. And so for me, online community has been really powerful.
Because 9 out of 10 people that you meet online will respond and want to help you and be in that personal board of directors.
Another young man up there with a question.
Yes.
I haven't read everybody's book, but I've read The Confidant. But a couple of things that stand out is these expressions, me to the we, and Symphony of Civilization. You know, I wrote that one down. But reading about Anna, another word that comes up is infrastructure and part of the connective tissue of our community. And, you know, we have to have this adversarial relationship between public sector and private sector that's been going on since the early 80s. And in World War II, when you think of World War II, you might be familiar with the battles and the arsenal of democracy. But for Anna, it was labor relations, bringing it back to the unions. So that was, for me, an eye-opener reading Chris's book, is that, yeah, labor relations, having everyone get along helps you win a war. It helps your community. It helps your profit margin. It's, you know, it's just a healthy thing to have going on rather than making it this, what it's been turned into is kind of adversarial relationships. So I want to bring that to you.
No, that's
Chris and everyone else.
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, that helped the ability to mediate at that level and with that equity helped America win World War II. I mean, and that doesn't get the press that the arsenal of democracy. You know, Chrysler was building the tanks and Ford was building the planes, and that's kind of the story that people many of us know, and people think we know the whole story about World War II, but you widen the lens of history, and you start to realize that, whoa, we needed really, really sophisticated labor relations, and the president needed someone who was able to sort of spearhead those relations during this most critical moment. Absolutely.
Yeah. In our book, we talk about every top crisis needs what a mega community, and a mega community is when the corporate sector, and including unions, come together, the nonprofit sector, and the government. Why are we all here today? Because those three sectors came together quickly for solutions for the pandemic. And so you need a diversity of sectors and types of organizations, such as union, nonprofit, and government, to solve these really wicked problems.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hi there. Thanks for sharing so much. I'm Allison Lane. Hi, I ran PR and marketing for SAS, Unilever, Burt's Bees, The Body Shop, 25 years. 2 weeks before the pandemic, I quit because I got a new boss who was like, everything you did before, we're going to change it, and it's not that valuable. And I was like, I'm going to put a pencil through your eye.
Well, fortunately, you didn't, because you're standing here. Yeah. Fortunately, you found a different...
I did not enjoy that meeting. Just before this, I came from another talk with about leadership and about personal strength. Mm-hmm. And all of you have mentioned this word resilience. Mm. They did too. But I want to share a perspective if they were in the room. Not, I don't know them. Amy Edmondson and mm-hmm. Karen Dillon.
Yep.
And then see how you four can get together and like solve everyone's problems.
You might be here a minute, but.
You talked about centering and getting inside and getting in touch with your values. And Amy said the most important element that they had talked about was resilience, but that resilience cannot be built as an adult. You have to build it as a child, and that resilience can be a team sport. Mm-hmm. Those are quotes. So, and then as adults, we have these challenges. Is it mental health or is it mental illness? Is it neurodivergency or neurotypical, or are we just a neuro and mental ability? I don't know. I have a hard time with these words that are negative and positive. So my question is this: how does resiliency and the mental health that we all want these next generations and our children to build, how do we do that in a way that when they do get to Wharton or wherever they're going to go to school, or that they have this tool, this inner knowing to build upon?
I love Amy, and I respect her, and she blurred my book. But as a mother of three children, that feels like an awful lot of pressure that I'm going to F up my kids, and they're not going to be resilient in time.
Even as an uncle, I was feeling that.
Yes. Well, and I think resilience, I mean, I think, and Maura, you talk about this, and this really struck home with me. When you grow up, we talk about childhood hurts, right? But childhood does, on the double-edged sword of all this, I mean, you know, both my parents left school at 12. My mother worked 6 days a week. She had six kids in 6 years, so she did work 6 days a week to just because it was crazy at home. And I was an adult from when I was 10, right? And there are lots of things that I carried around for a long time because of that, but I was also incredibly resilient, right? Because it was built into the way that I grew up. So, and I think there are lots of people who have these stories about how their lives were. I think, President Wood, you said something about, you're a latchkey kid. You knew how to, and you had to get on the subway in New York because you had to.
Right.
Now, I do think, and this is a common topic of conversation these days, that we are not developing the younger generation of leaders to be as resilient. And, you know, most of us say, you know, we do not want people to have to go through what some of us went through as children to be resilient. And I'm not sure I agree that resilience can't be learned, right? I'm not sure. I know their work a little bit. But I think there are techniques for making yourself able to handle situations, if that's what resilience in that sense, right? And I think, but I do think that helping our younger colleagues convince them that they can work these things through themselves. right? They can actually work it out. I tell this story all the time of a young man. Now, this young man is at a very large, well-known money manager in town. He's a Harvard Business School graduate. His mother called his boss about his performance review.
I like that mother.
But we can't. Right, how do you, you know, I think there's a way to, like, not have that happen to you. It didn't help. Let me just say it didn't help his career very much. So, you know, I think that I do think there are techniques to teach you to become more resilient in how you handle things. No?
I just want to say that we can have mental health and mental illness.
Yes.
And we mostly do. No one gets out of here unscathed, you know, so I think that keeping this, everything's so binary. Life isn't, you know? Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I agree with you. I think the values are foundational. And we all want to be loved through life, and love helps to empower resilience. And then we got to have people do stretch assignments. And I don't mean stretch assignments in class. I mean stretch assignments in life to learn how to build that resiliency. As a child, we didn't have navigation systems. I don't even know how we got around and did road trips, right? But that built resiliency
on
and
your a skill set. Yeah.
Right.
Because we got lost a lot.
We got lost a lot. Yeah.
That's a good metaphor.
Yeah.
We lost a lot. The mistakes we make are the ones that we remember.
Yep. Perfect. Right. Thank you. And I think we have time for one last question. And then there we go. Perfect timing.
Very simple question by a simple mind. Do you think that one of the causes of anxiety on a personal level is the idea that you have to be perfect about everything?
Yeah.
And that we have to keep reminding ourselves, well, you know, I'm not going to be 100%, but maybe I'll make it at 70. Is that a good approach, or is that...
I definitely think you're right, and as the panel have said, is social media has made it worse. The need to be perfect, and you see anxiety levels coming up on college campuses because people don't post the bad things on social media. Everybody looks perfect there.
I would add to that that in my case, the perfect is the enemy of the good. This was my first book, and I had written some shorter articles, but not anything book length. And if I aimed for perfection, I'd still be writing it, and maybe it would never come out. So I did have to say, well, sometimes 75% is just going to have to be good enough.
Mm-hmm. And Maura, you say that specifically in your book. I mean, we're almost out of time, but I do want to say you say very specifically, sometimes 75% of what you could do is just fine.
But you have to practice it. I have a course about managing perfectionism on LinkedIn Learning, if anyone is struggling as a leader. But, like, just try. Yep. Just try not being amazing or not stressing out or losing.
See how we do, exactly. Well, on that note, all I want to do is thank our panelists for an incredible conversation.
Thank you.
And their books are all the way down there, so they are going to make their way to the back where those three beautiful thrones are.
They really are.
They are thrones. They look like thrones from here, and you can go join them in with their books. Thank you.
Dara, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Dr. Whitney. Maura. Thank you.